From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
The weed of crime bears bitter fruit.
I don't like this.
Did you think you'd get away with it?
Come on, Duke!
Did you think I wouldn't know? The shadow knows.
Perhaps that explains why a novel theory of the SEC's is being called shadow trading. A corporate insider may think he got away with it. After all, he used inside information from his company to trade in the stock of a rival company. But it seems like the SEC is trying to show that, like the shadow, it knows all. Ask former Medivation executive Matthew Panawat. A California jury convicted him in the regulator's first enforcement action targeting so-called shadow trading. Joining me is securities law expert James Park, a professor at UCLA Law School. Jim, this case has been called groundbreaking. Do you think it's groundbreaking? And if so, why?
It is in some ways, but in other ways, I think it's a standard case. The reason why it's unusual is I believe it's the first time the SEC has brought and won a case involving something called shadow trading, which is a type of insider trading where you're using information that you obtain from your own company to trade in the stock of another company. This is the first time the SEC has brought such a case and pursued serious sanctions. It's not all that unusual, though, in that most of the sort of outcome hinged upon factual issues. Did you believe that this individual got and read the email from the CEO, which said that the company was going to be acquired? Factual issues, which are fairly routine in insider trading cases. And I think you could argue that this is a straightforward extension of existing law that has been in place since the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in United States versus O'Hagan. But I do think that it is significant because it shows the SEC is willing to bring these types of cases and could do so in the future.
What was the evidence against the defendant here?
Some of the evidence was circumstantial. So they knew the CEO sent an email that included him and other individuals in the company. They didn't necessarily know, though, whether or not he read the email. And he claimed at trial that he did not read the email. But what they do know is that 7 minutes after the email was sent and would have been received, he spent $100,000 in options in this company that was likely to go up in price upon the announcement that his company would be acquired. And so that is circumstantial evidence. We don't know for a fact, 100% certainty that he actually knew of this inside information and that he read the email. But, that's what a jury's for. Does a jury believe his explanation for buying all of these options, which is that he read a research analyst report by Goldman Sachs and that he had been following this company for a long time? That's up to the jury. And recall that this is a civil case. It's not a criminal case where the SEC has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he violated Rule 10b-5, which is the major securities fraud provision that prohibits insider trading. They only have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence.
The defense also argued that the SEC couldn't prove that Panawat had an intent to defraud or scienter because he didn't know it was illegal to trade in a company that wasn't his employer and didn't conduct business with his employer. So his attorney told the jury, the evidence will show that the entire SEC case is an attempt to put thoughts in Mr. Panawat's head that were not there when he made the trades.
It's a substantial argument, and these cases depend on intent. And because we don't know for sure what someone's intent is, that's up for the jury to decide. And the jury looked at the evidence, and they believed circumstantially that he acted with bad intent. And, you know, one fact in favor of the SEC is that he buys $100,000 in options. His purchases represented around 80% of the options trading in that stock on that particular day. That is very unusual. And, you know, the other point I would make is that ignorance of the law is not a defense. Even if you don't know all the ins and outs of insider trading law, which is complicated, that is not a defense to liability. Now, he does have an argument that I just was not conscious of doing anything wrong because, you know, I didn't understand. I couldn't trade in the stock of other companies. And the fact of the matter is he signs the policy saying that you cannot use company information to trade in the securities of another publicly traded company. Now, you know, I think Mr. Panawat would say, you know, we sign all sorts of things when we join a new company. We may not read these things carefully, and I just didn't understand this. The jury could have decided you are accountable. You are accountable because you signed the policy and because you signed it, you have to follow it. And if you're not following it, you know you're deceiving your company. And that sort of deception is a type of misappropriation of the company's confidential information. You know, another argument he could make might be is, you know, I found a loophole and I'm gaming the system. I don't know how sympathetic the jury would be to that argument. But, you know, that is the sort of argument that one could give some weight to. But the jury rejected those arguments.
You mentioned the policy, the confidentiality agreement that Panawat signed. Could the SEC have brought this case without that confidentiality agreement?
This is the foundation of the case. Without this policy, the SEC would not have an insider trading case. You can only misappropriate confidential information and violate Rule 10b-5 based on inside information if you have a fiduciary duty to the corporation whose stock you're trading in, or you have agreed to keep information confidential. Those are the two mechanisms by which you can violate insider trading prohibition. The first avenue is called the classical theory of insider trading, and that actually does not apply to this case because Panawat does not have any fiduciary duties to Insight, which is the company that he traded in. He might have some fiduciary-like duties to his company, Medivation. But that's why, you know, this is seen or was seen as a type of loophole. It gets you around the classical theory. But there's a second theory, which has just as much status, has been approved by the Supreme Court, called the misappropriation theory. And under that theory, the deception is when you sign a policy of confidentiality with your company, that commits you to complying with that policy. And if you deceptively trade in violation of that policy, you have violated Rule 10b-5. So it is absolutely essential that they had a policy that specified you cannot trade in the securities of another publicly traded company. If they did not have that policy and a general policy of confidentiality, the SEC would not have had a case. Many public companies are adopting these types of broad insider trading policies that cover securities of other publicly traded companies.
Do you think that this case will survive an appeal, this theory?
It's always hard to say. I think on the factual determinations, there's not much of a basis for overturning the case. The vulnerable point to me, I think, is on scienter. I think that is the one argument that a judge on the Ninth Circuit or perhaps the Supreme Court could look at very closely on these facts and could be a little bit skeptical of the SEC's theory of the case. On the other hand, you know, these are typically factual matters. Scienter, fraudulent intent is a matter for the jury, and many appellate courts will defer to that, and the Supreme Court may not think of this as a good vessel for clarifying the boundaries of insider trading law.
the SEC has been criticized for pushing into new territory and stretching its enforcement powers beyond its jurisdiction. For example, bringing cases over a McDonald's CEO's relationship with an employee, the workplace culture at a video game developer, and several cutting-edge cases to gain greater control over cryptocurrency.
That is the criticism. And one response the SEC might have is that these are novel problems. And the reason we were not addressing them before is the SEC was too passive. We need to get out there. We need to enforce the law to novel situations and educate people about what the law is. You can't simply ignore these broader standards and principles. And if you're applying the definition of insider trading and misappropriation and security and good faith, you would know that in some cases that there are violations of securities law. Now, the argument on the other side is that certainly the SEC has become more aggressive and I would say more entrepreneurial in certain ways. And part of that is that you have a more expansive, aggressive regulatory policy, and enforcement is a way to develop that policy. And, you know, there are positives and negatives, I think. But recall that there are times when the SEC is criticized as too passive, too much of a bureaucracy captured by the industry because the lawyers want to get good jobs with law firms. And so, you know, I think either way, if you're too passive, if you're too aggressive, the SEC is going to face some criticism for its enforcement policies. But I would say that I do think that this administration, for better or worse, has implemented a more entrepreneurial or aggressive approach to enforcement.
Finally, how big a victory is this for the SEC? A 10 on a 10 scale or 5?
It's a big victory. Every trial win is a big thing and a good thing for the SEC because you're not just settling cases. That's the criticism of the SEC, is that too often they just settle cases. The defendant doesn't admit to wrongdoing or deny it. And the SEC has been afraid or doesn't have the resources to actually go in front of judges and juries and test their theory. So I think this is a very significant, and, you know, along with their win in the Coinbase motion to dismiss, it's been a good few weeks for the SEC. And these are needed wins because when you're getting criticized for stretching the law, regulating by enforcement, the surest response is winning cases in court. And, you know, they have won these cases. They need to keep litigating cases and winning them fairly consistently in order to enhance the legitimacy of their enforcement efforts.
Thanks so much, Jim. That's Professor James Park of UCLA Law School. Coming up, the 2024 election is already being fought out in the courts. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
That was a rigged election, and it's a shame that we had to go through it. It's very bad for our country.
We've heard that false claim from Donald Trump about the 2020 presidential election over and over and over, despite the fact that 60 court cases found no evidence of fraud or illegality. It seems to be part of Trump's repertoire.
The election is being rigged by corrupt media pushing false allegations and outright lies in an effort to elect Hillary Clinton president.
Of course, he dropped those rigged election claims after he won, but they're just below the surface of this year's election.
Republicans must win. We want to landslide. We want it to be too big to rig.
Will there be a repeat this year of the litigation frenzy that followed the 2020 election? Well, the election is more than 6 months away, but political groups are filing so many lawsuits over voting rules that the numbers could reach the record set in that bitterly contested election. The Democratic and Republican parties have raised about $41.3 million to spend on court fights, and nonprofits, including some dark money groups, have likely raised hundreds of millions more. Joining me is elections law expert Derek Mueller, a professor at Notre Dame Law School. Fighting over election rules in court is big business for lawyers and the groups challenging them. Just how big?
So we know that the political parties can collect significant amounts of money earmarked, designated for election expenses. So the RNC and DNC have large pools of money, you know, that are upwards of $100 million a year now to be thinking about these kinds of expenditures. So they have significant funds that they can use to involve themselves in litigation, to start litigation, to intervene in litigation. But it's not even just the parties. The growth of additional 501c3s, nonprofits, organizations dedicated to rooting out voter fraud or protecting democracy or whatever we might label the organizations. And those, we don't even have a sense of the scope and scale of these things. So it's significant amounts of money coming into the system specifically for litigation.
And there are groups, nonprofits, where we don't know where their money is coming from or how they're spending it.
So when it comes to the DNC or the RNC, we know their donors. We know the individuals who have contributed to these entities. You know, there are limitations about what PACs can contribute to parties. So we have some transparency about where that money is coming from, at least in terms of the direct contributions to the parties. Where the so-called dark money groups comes in would be if there are other outside groups on the right or the left who are starting litigation, engaged in litigation, funding litigation, intervening in litigation, who want to support or promote certain kinds of laws or anticipate those ahead of the 2024 election. So you've seen some of these organizations from, you know, former government officials, you know, both on the right and the left, who support Trump, who oppose Trump. You know, I think we often think of it in those terms, maybe rather than Republican and Democrat these days. But those organizations, you know, we don't necessarily know where their funding's coming from, who's supporting them, or the reasons why they're litigating. But when it comes to the parties, at least, we have some pretty good transparency.
This, you know, sort of fierce challenging of election laws and minutiae in election laws, did it start after Bush v. Gore, or did it start in 2020?
It keeps rising. So there's lots of inflection points. So Professor Rick Hasson has tracked how Bush versus Gore was sort of the first wave of these things. Because Bush versus Gore, it's not just that, you know, a very small margin in Florida could affect the outcome of a presidential election. It also signified that the federal courts were open for business about how you did a recount, right? How your machines were counting ballots. So we see a steady uptick in election litigation after the 2000 election. But again, there are different inflection points that arise, you know, throughout this period of time as states introduce voter identification laws, and those become a sort of rallying cry and a challenging point for different groups or different legislatures. We see just a significant uptick in litigation around those things. The Cromnibus Bill of 2014-2015 creates this mechanism for more funding in elections. You know, after the 2016 election, we see Green Party candidate Jill Stein pressing for recounts around the United States. In 2020, we see the run-up to the election is a lot of changes due to COVID, and then there's just tons of litigation being filed to challenge the rules or to request accommodations from the rules, followed by all of those challenges after the 2020 election. So every cycle just seems to be bringing its own new challenges, new crises, new rallying points to fundraise off of. You know, a lot of election laws that were enacted by legislatures in the past that might have been ignored or sort of just moved beyond and party organizers would have accommodated them or handled them now are being challenged. Almost any change to your election machinery in very basic terms, from the buying of a machine to the list maintenance of your voter rolls, gets challenged by some group on the right or the left. So we're just seeing this escalation. Again, I think part of it is the availability of funding, and maybe part of it is the awareness that parties think that very small differences can matter. And so they want to challenge as much as they can, anticipating that a small change might matter in their election.
And are the big groups that are challenging and defending these laws, are they all tied to a party or a candidate? Are any of them independent?
So a number are at least ostensibly independent, right? But a number of them do tend to file on one side or the other. So some of them will have former Republican officials, think about restoring integrity and trust in elections, the Honest Elections Project, or things like that. Or some of them will have former Democratic officials, sort of never Trump officials who are participating. Some of them, States United Democracy Center, Protect Democracy, or some of these organizations tend to file much more heavily on the Democratic side than the Republican side. So you can trace what these organizations are doing and see where their officials are. And they can't formally coordinate with the parties, right? Because if you have that coordination, it creates campaign finance problems. But instead, they are going around, they're filing litigation. And again, places maybe where the party doesn't have the resources to do it or isn't aware of it or wants another group rather than the party to be involved. That said, the parties do still have some significant involvement. I'd say the most significant party-led litigation right now is Democratic National Committee leading a number of challenges to keep Robert F. Kennedy's name off the ballot in a number of states, I think viewing him as a third-party threat. I think the RNC might view him as a threat too, but hasn't filed those challenges. So again, it's hard to pin down exactly who's leading the litigation in some of these places. It's following the headlines, seeing who's led on the docket, what the lead party's name is, and then trying to identify, you know, who they tend to support or where their attorneys have come from.
And it seems like so many of these lawsuits
are not helping to clarify things, but they're attacking this minutia to deter the process.
So I think about this from kind of an economic standpoint. If you have limited resources to challenge the rules governing elections, you are going to challenge the things that you think are the biggest deal, right? The most important ones, the ones that you think are really truly changing the game. And that's also the case that if you didn't have money earmarked for litigation, as a campaign, you would have to make a judgment call. Do I think this $250,000 is better spent on advertisements in our district or on litigating, you know, this absentee voter rule or this Dropbox rule or whatever it is? So in the past, you would focus your resources on those things that were the most salient issues that you thought had the highest likelihood of winning and those things that you thought were better uses of resources than sort of ordinary political expenses. Now, when you earmark the funds, you are saying this money is for only litigation. These contributions can only be for litigation purposes. So you don't have to make that trade-off. And the more resources you have, the more money you have to spend on litigation, then the more things you can challenge. And the more things you challenge, by definition, you are challenging weaker and weaker claims or more and more marginal claims, more and more minutia of elections to say, you know, we're dealing with a very small subset of what we think could be at stake here. So we can say, you know, at a very high level, of course, we want elections to be run fairly and with integrity. We want every eligible voter to have a reasonable opportunity to vote, and we don't want that vote unreasonably burdened. But we now expect a lot of things, even what we could describe as fairly small things, about how elections are run, you know, how counties are purchasing voting equipment or the methods they use to tabulate ballots are just being routinely challenged. So many of these lawsuits just don't go anywhere. They're not going to end up being successful, or even if they're successful at the district court level, they're likely to be reversed on appeal. So we're watching that escalation and trying to calculate what's the actual added value at the end of the day? How much of it is win-loss rate and how much of it is convincing donors or convincing those who you fundraise from to say, hey, we've filed a lawsuit. We're fighting the fight. And even if we lose, the point is we're fighting. So that's been a change in the dynamic, I would say, over the last couple of decades.
So could this year be worse in terms of election litigation than the seemingly endless litigation we saw in 2020?
Well, it could be. It always depends on how close it is, right? The closer the margin, the more litigation. Now, we say that, you know, 2020 in a way wasn't particularly close because you would have had to flip several states with somewhat significant margins of victory in those jurisdictions, even after a recount in places like Georgia. So we'll have to see, you know, if it's a Republican loss or an apparent Republican loss. There are a number of attorneys who promoted things in 2020 and filed lawsuits who are facing sanctions or have been disbarred. And I don't know if that's going to be sobering for attorneys on the Republican side to think about the quality of the claims they bring. And again, it depends on the size of the loss, the scope of the loss. And many of the strategies in 2020 turn on allegations that states changed their laws in the middle of the pandemic inappropriately. You're not going to see that kind of dynamic effect in 2024. And there are changes to the Electoral Count Reform Act that sort of tighten some of the deadlines and force governors to submit certificates in an earlier and more timely fashion. So I think there's a decent chance we would see less litigation on that front. For Democrats in a close loss, again, it's hard to know exactly what that would look like, you know, how many resources would be focused on certain jurisdictions to allege their violations of federal law. Again, I think it depends on the kinds of jurisdictions where places like Pennsylvania, where you have more disparate methods in how ballots are counted across counties, you have more opportunities to bring those challenges and to try to get more absentee or other kinds of ballots counted, which might redound to the benefits of whichever candidate is trailing at the time. But it's a high degree of uncertainty. We might see more in 2024. And, you know, I go back to the 2000 election. We didn't see a lot of states with litigation. We just saw a lot of litigation concentrated in one state. I think the thing about 2020 that was more remarkable was seeing how diffuse and spread out the litigation was. I think that's less likely to see that kind of litigation spread out. But if the election turns on a close result in one or two states and not just four or five states, I would not be surprised to see a significant uptick in litigation.
So I guess what we do is hope for wide margins. Thanks so much for your insights, Derek. That's Professor Derek Muller of Notre Dame Law School. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Plus years of service, combat medals, citations. Yet you can't get a promotion, you won't retire, and despite your best efforts, you refuse to die. The kind is headed for extinction.
Maybe so, sir, but not today.
Certainly not today or even tomorrow. In fact, there's already another sequel to the sequel in the works, Top Gun 3. After all, Top Gun Maverick grossed nearly $1.5 billion at the box office, Tom Cruise's biggest film. So Paramount must have been breathing a huge sigh of relief when a judge threw out a copyright lawsuit seeking some of the profits from that 2022 sequel. A California federal judge found that the sequel featured a plot, settings, characters, and themes that diverged far from anything found in the article that inspired the first Top Gun movie. Here to unravel all this is intellectual property litigator Terrence Ross, a partner at Katten-Muchin Rosenman. Terry, this suit was by the heirs of the writer who wrote the article that inspired the original movie. Why were they suing Paramount over Top Gun Maverick?
Way back in 1983, Hood Yunay wrote this article in California Magazine on the Top Gun program down at the U.S. Navy Fighter Weapons School, but wrote it in sort of an interesting way where he wrote it from the perspective of a pilot in his backseat going through the program. And it caught somebody's eye in Hollywood, and Paramount went out and got an assignment of rights for a movie from him. When I look at such agreements, I was focused on what's the credit being called for, you know, at the end of the movie. And he got like the lowest possible credit you could get, which is suggested by a story written by Hood Yunay. I mean, suggested by is like the lowest language you can get and still get some sort of credit. But they had complete rights in the article for purposes of the movie, and they went out and made the movie. Unclear whether they really needed those rights, but they did it. So the United States Copyright Act has a provision in it that allows heirs to a copyright to terminate a license in the copyright years after the license was given, on sort of the theory that young up-and-coming writers, artists often get cheated in these licenses, and so we have to leave a window of opportunity later on if the work has been worth something for them to recover some value. So they're allowed to terminate the license. And after Yone's death in 2018, his son and widow did exactly that. They sent a letter to Paramount saying they've terminated the rights in the 1983 California Magazine article because they had seen somewhere that there was a sequel being worked on. And that sort of got us up to the Top Gun Maverick, the sequel.
The judge seemed to address every possible angle here. One thing he said was similarities between the two works based on facts can't be protected. So doesn't that pretty much cover everything? Because the initial magazine article was nonfiction, right? It was about real people.
So I agree with you, June. As the judge found at one point, the magazine article was really just a factual recitation of what went on at U.S. Navy's fighter weapons school down in Miramar. And therefore, there really wasn't much that could be protected by copyright. And I have to say, I mean, you said the judge went through this carefully. I agree with you completely. Judge Anderson did a very careful job here with this decision. He went through every possible argument raised by the plaintiffs and succinctly described what was wrong with those arguments as a matter of law, which is going to make it very hard to appeal this case to the Ninth Circuit.
Why did Paramount even get a license for the first movie? It seems like they wouldn't have needed a license.
So in the age of copyright lawsuits at the drop of a hat that we live in, lawyers in-house at creative organizations such as Paramount Pictures tend to be very careful. And the cost of getting a license here was relatively inexpensive. They didn't have to give away much credit in the movie for getting the license. The price was relatively low, as these things go. So, I mean, it made sense. Even if the in-house lawyer thought there was no need to get a copyright license, why not get it as an insurance mechanism? I sort of get it, although it did lead to these problems down the road. At that point in time, back in 1984, I think it was a very reasonable decision on the part of the Paramount lawyers.
So, Terry, will you go through some of what the judge considered in making this decision?
So, you know, the plaintiff raised a number of alleged similarities between the Top Gun Maverick and this California Magazine article. I think I saw somewhere in the opinion that was on the order of magnitude of 70 different alleged similarity. And the judge sort of said they all fit into certain categories. And he went through them category by category and pointed out there are certain things that are just not protected by copyright. We talked about facts. They're not protected. So the fact that there is this Top Gun program, the fact that Navy pilots that are selected to go through it are the best in the Navy, those are all factual elements that get no protection whatsoever. But then there are literary expression elements that also get no protection. So general plot ideas, a murder mystery, you can't protect that. You know, stock characters, the detective solving the mystery, the British secret agent, you don't get protection for that. And then there are certain sens are fair, which are sort of situations that arise naturally out of the plot. So if you've got a World War II drama set in Europe, the bad guys are going to be Nazis, right? And they're going to be wearing swastikas. You don't get to copyright that. All of those things are unprotected. And the bulk of what was in the California Magazine article, which is the allegedly infringed work, fit into a category such as that.
The plaintiff's attorney said they disagree with the court's ruling, particularly on summary judgment, and they will appeal. Now, the Ninth Circuit has warned against dismissing copyright lawsuits before allowing experts to testify. And here the judge excluded testimony from the plaintiff's expert. How does that play in?
So the Ninth Circuit has cautioned district court judges about dismissing copyright lawsuits at too early a point in the case, particularly prior to a jury trial. The defendants had brought a motion to dismiss right after the complaint was filed, the earliest possible time to get a dismissal. It's basically an attack on the pleading itself, saying the way you've pled this doesn't amount to a cognizable legal claim. And the court had heard that way back in November of 2022, if I recall correctly, and said, oh, look, this is way too early. I think within the four corners of the complaint, the judge said, within this, I think there's enough to make out a cognizable legal claim, but I'm not going to comment upon where this might go in the future. So we go through discovery, we get expert reports, and Paramount comes back at the end of discovery, the last thing you do before the jury trial, and files a motion for summary judgment and says, Your Honor, we're back. You said we needed to allow the facts to be developed and get expert testimony. We did. And we say this is still not a legally cognizable claim, and therefore we should be entitled to summary judgment. And at that point, I think the judge was perfectly within his rights to consider such a motion. And given what we now know about those various alleged points of infringement, I think the judge got it right and was allowed to do this on summary judgment. Now, there's a second question that's raised by the plaintiff, which is, well, yes, you did allow experts to give testimony, but you refuse to accept the testimony of our expert, this is where it gets complicated. In my view, it was not that the plaintiff wasn't allowed to put up expert testimony. In my view, and I think in the judge's view, the plaintiff, copyright owners, put up expert testimony that wasn't competent and relevant to the case. The expert for the plaintiff had failed to take into account any of these defenses to copyright infringement, you know, that they're just facts, that their sense are fair, that they're non-protectable elements. The expert for the plaintiff had just assumed everything was copyrightable. And the judge said, you know, that's what this case is all about, whether or not it's copyrightable, whether it's protectable in the first place. You can't assume that away. Therefore, your expert opinion is of no value here, and we're not going to allow it. And I, again, think the judge got that right. And therefore, I really do not think that that's a legitimate complaint on appeal. I'm sure the plaintiffs will appeal to the Ninth Circuit and raise this point, but judges have enormous discretion at the trial court level into what testimony they will allow into evidence, what they will not, and I just don't see the Ninth Circuit overturning his decision here.
And let me just say that you are on record that when we discussed this case, when the suit was first filed, you said it wasn't going to fly, so to speak. So I just want to credit you for that, Terry.
Well, I appreciate the credit.
Not that it gets you anything.
You know, when you've been doing this as long as I have, you sort of get a flavor for the types of cases that get brought. And, you know, one of the really telling things to me was the plaintiffs were only able to identify a single sentence, and the sentence is being generous because it's only a two-word sentence, a single sentence of dialogue that was similar between the article and Top Gun Maverick, the sequel. And that's one of the things I always look for. Are there a lot of similarities in dialogue? Are there really unique settings that are similar? And here, the only dialogue that was similar was a phrase, fight on, which apparently is the code word at the Top Gun school that these pilots use to say that the mock engagement is starting. And again, you know, that's telling that that's the only dialogue similarity they could come up with. And quite frankly, it itself is not copyrightable because the Copyright Office does not allow copyrights in short phrases. That would come within that exception to the rule. So when you look at it and you see no dialogue similar, no settings that are really unique, and just all these generalities, it's impossible to not have this gut reaction that this isn't going to go anywhere, this is going to get dismissed. I guess I got it right this time.
You always get it right. But why appeal then? I'd say they're looking for some sort of settlement, but is Paramount going to want to settle when Top Gun 3 is coming out? And they have the win.
I don't know what this plaintiff's specific motivation will be to appeal. And I can only tell you in general how attorneys think about this. And, you know, there's no doubt that this had to have been, I have no inside information, but this had to have been a contingent fee litigation where the lawyer only gets paid if they win. So that's a factor. Second, Top Gun Maverick made an enormous amount of money. I believe the box office gross was $1.5
billion. Yep.
And I think it had to do something with the timing of being one of the first released after the pandemic and people are coming back in theaters and desperate for content. But if you can believe this, June, that is the largest gross of any Tom Cruise movie of all time. It's bigger than the Jack Reacher movies. It's bigger than any of the, I don't know, we're up to six or seven
Mission Impossible
series. And this is an enormous amount of money. And, you know, the argument for damage, if there was copyright infringement, is that we're entitled to the reasonable royalty based on that amount. And so the amount at stake is enormous. And so when you have large amounts at stake, even if you have a minimal chance of success, you know, the math works out that you ought to pursue the appeal on the off chance that you get two out of three judges on the appellate panel who have some problem with what the district court did. And of course, the longer it drags out, the hope on the plaintiff's side is always that defendants get tired of paying their attorneys, because this is expensive sort of litigation, and that they might just consent to a settlement, and so they get some money out of it. And you're right, Top Gun 3, the script is already being written. There are negotiations with director and other principal roles, so it looks like it's semi-green lit already, and so there's that much more money to be had. And that's my speculation, my opinion, based on past experience as to why they might appeal.
Well, you have a winning record on this show, Terry, so I trust your opinions. Thanks so much. That's Terrence Ross of Katten, Rosenman. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Podcast. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by subscribing and listening to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at Bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.